I started, you know, when my father was a police officer, and he once said to me, you know, I have a feeling that you'll probably end up doing something like I've done, Rob, but, you know, you might want to look at the fire service. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. I totally get it, just because that's where our family's always had some sort of service. And so, long and short, I joined up the Explorers in Easton, which is a neighboring town, obviously, from back in, I want to say 82. So, and I became a full member in 86. So, I've been a volunteer firefighter since then. And so, I went down that road of being, wanting to be a paid firefighter, but I ended up being a biologist and a director for land use here in town. So I had my municipal job, and I didn't have to tell Barbara I wasn't doing anything other than my wife, anything other than volunteer for the rest of my life. And I felt that was a good place to be. So, and being a volunteer firefighter, I think shows also for my family, for my kids, you know, just, you know, this is where you need to be. You need to be at a place to be able to help. So, you know, when I heard about, something that we can draw upon, and I have lots of books and readings that I look to, but I don't think there's one in particular that I can pull out specific to the service of being a firefighter. And that, to me, spoke to something that I had never particularly thought, oh, I need to have something for this service. I can just draw from everything I've always drawn from in my life, which is music or, you know, the Bible or some sort of sacred writing. So this is wonderful to be able to point to. You know, the last 4 or 5 years, we've had some particularly bad storms. We've had 4 declared disasters in the state of Connecticut, and I'm the assistant director of emergency management for the town. So I've watched people around me have some very difficult times through natural disaster and through the loss of fire or an accident and everything. So it's been a particularly long road over the last few years. Then to have something like 1214, which is the unimaginable happening, I think is where you begin to reach out to a lot of times to areas that you probably, you know, didn't know that was even there. You know, there are issues that you have to deal with whenever you're dealing with loss and trauma, and grief and all those different things. But you're constantly searching. And there's no silver bullet, you know, for this type of process.
Yeah.
You know, there's something to be said about a road of healing. It means that one day you will be healed, but also trusting in your faith. If you're not walking hand in hand there, the road becomes much longer. So, that's why I appreciate, you know, this good work, and I look forward to using it to continue that road of healing, but also to continue to do the thing that I feel I've been called to for the last quarter century, which is to be a resource for those who are in need, whether it's an accident or a fire, or whether it's just an example for family and for the community. So,
how have you and your fellow first responders here sustained yourselves? Has community been strong?
You know, it's we're still all in shock. You know, whether you go down the list of the Red Cross or whatever group of crisis intervention, you know, will look to you and say you're going to go through these different layers. You know, and I could probably do them rote right now from memory. And I think one of the issues that I would say is that we've never been unsustained. We've always been able to continue to serve, but the shock of what we're all dealing with, and it's what's unusual about this scenario is not that the responses through our emotions or through the personnel have been any different than it would be for any disaster, but it was the layering of exposure that defines a lot of times how people are reacting. There were individuals who had to go into the building to rescue or to protect. There were first responders who specifically were there for counseling and for literally holding someone up during the telling of a death. You know, there were those who witnessed. There were those who, you know, who literally were exposed to a vision that no one should be exposed to. You know, there was the aftermath, which is the following day, during the day of removing the bodies and dealing with that kind of stuff. Every person, and you're not talking about even 100 people. You're talking about less than 100 people directly involved on scene. So of the firefighters, I was one of maybe a dozen who actually went there, and no firefighters were allowed in. The EMS, no EMS were allowed in. The ambulance service actually was stationed at the firehouse and never made it to the grounds. The police that went in, and the state and the tactical teams that went in, and the medical examiners. The reason I even had to stay around, I arrived, I don't know if you knew this or not, my wife was on the scene at the time of the shooting. She was at the front door, and by God's grace, she was able to escape. With three children who attend Sandy Hook, I became a very self-aware immediately because I received a phone call very similar to what I think a lot of people from 9/11 received, which is, you know, there's a gunman after me, take care of the kids, I love you. And, you know, that's it. And so I was only 3 minutes away, so I was there, you know, within the first 10 minutes and was on scene well after the fire and EMS had been removed because of my position in emergency management. And I think that exposure and then the removal of the bodies afterwards was some of the more difficult things that all the first responders have to deal with. And in particular that I'm dealing with, but also the fact that that I had children in there and that my wife was at risk. And then, you know, to know all the kids and the people and there's a lot going on. How the firefighters are reacting right now is each to their own ability. The support services are there, but we need to be able to know what fits best for each of us. And this book could be one of those things that helps them tremendously. So, yeah.
Now, the three of you were, in a way, representatives of a much larger constituency today.
Right.
Do you envision that fellow firefighters and state police or other law enforcement would be receptive to
I
spiritual
believe so.
Source?
I don't think anybody is. I don't think anybody can really draw upon their own individual psyche to be able to deal with this. I think people are finding faith in ways that they never dreamed they would have, and in your service that a lot of times we're told just to compartmentalize, do what you need to do, figure out your duty, and then move on. And a lot of times that doesn't bode well for later on in life. And right now the police, are feeling, I think a particularly difficult road to wander along, because you had some brothers and sisters who went directly in the building to deal with something, whether they were state, whether they were a neighboring. I mean, literally when the all call went out, you were talking about a guy who might have been a police officer in Bethel who was off duty, who happened to be on the road next door, came to the scene. So you ended up with a real mishmash of representatives in there trying to tactically make sure that the scene was safe for the survivors. So I think they would be. I don't know really an avenue into it. Each of us really protects in the fire department, we're given such, you know, depth and breadth to be able to have whatever we feel is necessary time and energy mm-hmm. for, whether it's going to church or whatever it is, you know, you don't need to come to a drill, whatever it is. And there's no stigma associated with it, but in the police service, I think there's more of a right now, there is a protective cloak that has been dropped around a lot of the officers, and they really are very protective of each other right now. You know, all I can tell you is a couple guys that I've talked to have really. They've really asked me to not betray any trusts or discuss things out of turn. And so I think that they definitely would be receptive to any tools to continue to heal. Absolutely.
Sure. So. One last question for you. In the broader circles of from here forward, beyond the presentation of, you know, these brief devotions with a scripture and a little story and then a prayer that... have been written for first responders, a revision of the original book,
right,
geared towards first responders. What can the larger community, and I mean larger, more than just Danbury or Fairfield, but yeah. I mean the yeah. broad constituency, do to help you find strength or to help you as a collective group to heal?
Well, you know, I keep telling my wife this, and this is something that's very interesting. We there's a sort of numbness and levelness that your emotions try to put you into, so that your lows are not so low and your peaks are therefore also kept to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And but one of the things that has continually kept me rising rather than falling is the reach out or the outreach of those, either through written correspondence or through an act or through even prayer. I think the you know, almost million pieces of correspondence that was received, my office where I am at Town Hall literally was shoulder deep in correspondence with letters. So, and for 2 months, we lived in a sea of letters. Anywhere from 10 to 15,000 letters would come in daily. And they would all be dropped on our desks or in the thing. So, I mean, the correspondence... my wife and I literally have received almost a trailer load's worth of materials and gifts for the kids and stuffed animals and, you know, other ways to reach out. And as the time goes by, and I'll never forget this, a guy from Ladder Company, I think it was Ladder 3 or 4, which was one of the hardest hits in 9/11. A guy called up a day later, and I was answering the phone doing communications. We were each assigned two or three guys at the firehouse. And I sat down and I was answering the phone. This guy called up and says, "Hey, I'm Joey Bag of Donuts from Ladder 3 down in Manhattan." And I say, hey brother, how you doing? Good to talk to you." And he says, "Hey, I just want you to know, you know, I'm thinking of you now." He says, "But I'm not going to belittle you with all, you know, all your accolades, good job, you know, all that kind of stuff." He says, "Because I know where it is right now, where it's couched." He says, "But," he says, "in 6 months, in 10 months, or in 16 months, you're going to be hearing from me. I'm going to be the one bringing you a hot meal. I'm the one that's going to be dropping in to see how you're doing, because that's when you're going to need it the most. Right. Because after it all kind of falls away, you know, what's going to be left there is what you're going to need to walk on with." And I was like, you know, I it was one of 1,000 calls that mm-hmm. I took. But it stuck with me. I think this is very much like that phone call. You know, it is natural to call and say, "We're grieving with you." Mm-hmm. And, you know, "We feel for you, and we wish you strength, and we're praying for you." But to have that later on, when that act is much more of a non-spontaneous but a sought, you know, mm-hmm. giving, mm-hmm. I think is really what the greater group is going to need. So that's why I can see something like this meaning a lot and becoming dog-eared and more.